Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we talk films and the films of Wes Anderson in particular. Films of Anderson can be an acquired taste. You either really like them a lot or dislike them a lot. His films like Rushmore, The Royal Tenenbaums, The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, The Darjeeling Limited, Moonrise Kingdom, and his latest, The Grand Budapest Hotel, all have a unique pacing, a meticulousness and attention to detail which reveals a level of auteurism uncommon today in American film. The very fact that actors like Bill Murray and Jason Schwartzman are always available to play a part in nearly every Anderson film, as well as top stars willing to play supporting or cameo roles, gives credence that Anderson is creating a unique film world. My guest today will provide entree into that film world. Film critic Matt Zoller Seitz shares his enthusiasm for Anderson's works in his book, The Wes Anderson Collection, which details his devotion to technique, how his stylistic scene craft and locations and scene choices owe to previous filmmakers. And the book offers copious details on every one of his films, from his first short, Bottle Rocket, made with collaborators Owen and Luke Wilson, through Moonrise Kingdom. Matt Zoller Seitz is the TV critic for New York Magazine and the editor-in-chief of RogerEbert.com. In fact, Booksmart Tulsa will be presenting its own version of the Wes Anderson Experience when they present the Seitz tomorrow evening from 6 to 8 at Philbrook. The event gets underway with costume contests, cocktails, posters, and T-shirts, the presentation with the author, and then at 8:30, guests are invited to go to the Circle Cinema for a screening of Anderson's first film, Bottle Rocket. Matt Zoller Seitz joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Matt Zoller Seitz, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You've had a long history with Wes Anderson, which becomes apparent in the new book, The Wes Anderson Collection. Going back to his very first film, how did you first find out about Wes Anderson? Because this goes back to the days of his short film, Bottle Rocket.
It does, yeah. Well, I first met Wes back in 1994, early 94. I was a critic for the Dallas Observer, which is the local weekly, and he was a filmmaker. He'd just gotten out of UT Austin, where he went to school with Owen Wilson, who would later be his co-writer and leading man. And the Wilson's family was from Dallas. Their mother, Owen Wilson, and his brother Luke Wilson, and Andrew Wilson, who's a producer, and their mother is Laura Wilson, who's a very fine photographer, who worked with Richard Avedon on the American West series. Anyway, Wes wanted to make a movie with these guys. They lived in Dallas, so he happened to be living there. They made the short film Bottle Rocket together, and they went to the Sundance lab with it. They weren't actually enrolled. They just audited, which is in the book, which is kind of a funny story. And they also got into the USA Film Festival in Dallas as part of the shorts program. And I came across the short film while I was watching all the shorts in that particular program, because I used to make a habit of writing about every single thing in the local film festival when I was at Dallas Observer.
Right.
And Bottle Rocket really jumped out at me. And I'd sort of made it a mission to single out the work of local filmmakers and sort of treat them as if they were nationally known people, you know, like try to give them a profile or some attention and maybe a picture and not just sort of bury it in the listings, which a lot of papers do. And Wes really jumped out at me because his style just seemed so assured, and it was black and white. It was heavily indebted to the French New Wave and to Peanuts and to a lot of other things as well, and yet it definitely felt like the product of a particular sensibility. And the actors in the movie were Owen and Luke Wilson, who, of course, are brothers, and they were in their mid-20s at the time, and so was Wes. But I really had no idea from just looking at the film that Wes was also that age, because it just felt like the work of somebody who had been doing this for a long time, not somebody who was just out of college. So that's how I met Wes. And then I went on to write a story about the making of Bottle Rocket, the feature, which was covered from start to finish, like all the way up to when they test screened it and disastrously and the studio lost faith in it. And that story's online if anybody wants to seek it out. And I've stayed in touch with Wes ever since. And I just talked to him again a couple of days ago about Grand Budapest Hotel, and he's very, very happy at how well that movie's doing.
Well, it's doing great.
As well he should be.
Well, I have not seen Bottle Rocket itself. I have the feature, but I haven't had a chance to watch it yet because I wanted to go back and see it. I want to know if that short sort of embodies the things we expect to see in a Wes Anderson film.
Yeah, it absolutely does. I mean, not everything. I would say the one caveat that I would give is that the early film, and Bottle Rocket and Rushmore are movies that are essentially light. And Rushmore has some darker undertones, but it's not until The Royal Tenenbaums that he gets really dark and he starts mixing very deep trauma and pretty serious violence in with the lightheartedness. And that becomes a signature Wes Anderson approach. But Bottle Rocket, the short film, and Bottle Rocket, the feature, it's more a stylistic thing. It's more a matter of tone and sense of humor and the way that people deliver lines and just the feel of it, the cutting, the very kind of jagged, playful cutting, and the intelligence that's put into the framing, just things like that.
Now, you said Bottle Rocket was disastrous. On going back and looking at it, is it a good film in retrospect, or was it something where studio had its hand in it, or maybe... That graduation from short to feature film, you know, that sort of the first time problems with making that jump?
Well, Wes has said, he says in the book that he's basically happy with the movie. It's his first feature. He was an unknown working for a major studio with James Caan and his cast, and all things considered, it turned out pretty well for him. He got a career out of it. But as the story that I wrote about him kind of discusses, he didn't have control over that movie. He didn't have creative control over that movie. And I got the impression, I'm still to this day not entirely sure about all the details because Wes is very circumspect about behind-the-scenes stuff, but James L. Brooks does not have the same sensibility as Wes Anderson. And the people who worked for James L. Brooks' company and for Columbia Pictures did not have the same sensibility as Wes Anderson. Wes's sensibility is something more like Rushmore, where it's widescreen. Every frame is packed with 26 different things. There's an undertone of melancholy to the humor. And, I feel like the Wes Anderson film as we know it begins with Rushmore. Bottle Rocket is an excellent start, but it doesn't feel complete to me. And as far as the studio goes, they backed him partly because they were betting on Quentin Tarantino. Like, the studios were betting on Quentin Tarantino and people like Quentin Tarantino to revitalize genre filmmaking. And this was a movie about petty criminals, and the success of Reservoir Dogs, which led directly to Pulp Fiction, I'm sure had something to do with the support that they gave to these guys. And Wes is not Quentin Tarantino. He's never going to be. He's not interested in the kinds of things Tarantino is interested in. And I always got the impression that Columbia felt like they bet on a bad horse when they looked at the finished film. And Wes himself has said to me that they made more or less the movie that they kind of always meant to make, and anybody who looks at the short film and then looks at the feature would go, yeah, that's pretty much what we expected these guys would do if you gave them a lot of money. And so I don't know why anybody was surprised, but they buried it. It was supposed to open in fall of 1995, and it was going to be a youth culture sort of hit. They were going to promote it, like, on MTV and stuff, I think, and they looked at it. There were a lot of walkouts during test screenings. The studio was not happy. The comments cards were terrible. Nobody knew what to make of it. A lot of people just didn't think it was funny. And it got buried. I think it opened like February the next year. It was very sad. He was really depressed about that. Everybody associated with the movie was depressed about it. They were happy that they got a career, but the experience itself was very complicated, and I get the impression there were some bad feelings.
Well, you mentioned that relationship with James L. Brooks that sort of took Wes in for that film, and you mentioned that Wes is widescreen. The opposite of it, I would think, would be James L. Brooks, who to me almost seems small screen, television, movies that are tugging on your heartstring from the start. It just doesn't seem like a very good match.
Well, I think I will say something for James L. Brooks, which is James L. Brooks has been a tremendous champion of new talent. And not just Wes Anderson, but The Simpsons exists because of James L. Brooks.
True.
And Mary Tyler Moore made the transition out of The Dick Van Dyke Show because of James L. Brooks, who was one of the lead producers on that. And there's a wonderful new book out by Jennifer Keeshan Armstrong about the making of The Mary Tyler Moore Show, which paints a very, very warm, flattering picture of James L. Brooks as just a human being. And The Fabulous Baker Boys, written and directed by Steve Clovis, that was a James L. Brooks discovery. Danny DeVito got his start as a director thanks to James L. Brooks. I mean, the list just goes on and on. Cameron Crowe, Say Anything, James L. Brooks.
Yeah.
So as a school for talent, I mean, he's right up there with Roger Corman. So I really can't say a word against the guy there. But, yeah, the sensibilities are not a perfect match. And, in fact, The closest, I would say, of all the people he's championed, the closest to Brooks' own sensibility is probably Cameron Crowe. And if you look at Say Anything and Singles and Jerry Maguire, you know, films like that, those films feel Brooksian, I guess, in a way that, like, Rushmore doesn't, and Royal Tenenbaums certainly doesn't, and so forth.
But out of Bottle Rocket comes Rushmore, which, you know, Bottle Rocket, a fairly flawed film in certain ways. Rushmore is nearly a perfect film by most film critics' account. It's an incredibly wonderful, wonderful film.
It is, yeah. And in fact, I called it a perfect movie in my piece about it in the book. And I do think it is. And it's very, very tight. Every scene, every line, every frame, every shot feels just about right. Like, there's nothing where you're looking at the movie and going, that could have been different, that could have been better, that could have been longer, that could have been shorter. It all feels perfect. And he's made a number of movies that are pretty close to that, I think. But Rushmore is the endlessly rewatchable early movie that everybody loves. And yet, the funny thing about it, and I've heard, I've certainly felt this way about a lot of his films, and I know a lot of people have told me that they felt this way. Rushmore gets sadder the more times you watch it.
Really?
You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Like it's a lovely, cheerful, wonderful, ultimately heartwarming time the first time, but then the more you see it, the more it doesn't seem quite so funny. Like, not in the way that it was the first time. And when I watch it now, my heart really goes out to Max.
Yeah, Max seems almost desperate in his sort of this approach to find his way in a life.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And he lost his mother at an early age, and so of course he's this little control freak. Like, he wants to, you know, he wants to create these worlds which he then lords over like a combination of a mother and a father and sort of a stern teacher and, like, you know, a vengeful god. Like, he wants to give life to things. He wants to, you know, he's constantly giving birth. He's giving birth to clubs. He's giving birth to plays. He wants to give birth to an aquarium. You know, there's a lot there. I mean, it would take a whole team of psychiatrists to get to the bottom of Max's issues. He's very, very complicated.
Right.
To be that young, and there's something tragic about him. I mean, ultimately he transcends it, but he's not sunshine and lollipops, that kid.
Right. And of course, the interesting thing about Rushmore is you have this theme in the piece that keeps showing up in film after film, and that is, in the case of Max, it's this kid who's looking for his way in a life, his purpose in life. And you have Mr. Bloom, who is the factory owner, played by Bill Murray, who has lost his way in life. And mm-hmm. he sort of finds something through Max. And that theme keeps showing up in film after film. People who are sleepwalking through life, like the Whitman brothers and Darjeeling Limited, who are sort of self-absorbed to the point that they're, you know, they don't have a purpose in life, and all of a sudden they find one through the experiences they get on the train. A Moonrise Kingdom, where you have the two lovers and the parents who have sort of forgotten what love and living and life is about. And,
yeah,
you know, I mean, so this theme keeps showing up time and time again of people who have lost their way, people finding their way, or people who absolutely know their way in life and sort of turn out to be a guide.
Yeah, that's true. They are sort of just feeling their way along. That's very true. And I would say related to that is this idea of people having been assigned particular roles by life or having constructed certain identities for themselves, realizing for a variety of reasons that this is not working for them and something has to change. And you see that time and time again. And to give you just one example, which you mentioned, Rushmore, what do we have in there? Well, we have this triangle. And it's a romantic triangle, but it's not, because Miss Cross is not interested in Max. He's too young. Even if he was the right age, she might not be interested in him. There's an element of seeing the guy who would have been her husband in Max. Like, there's something about him, and there's almost like he finds that book in the library, which is inscribed by him, and that she donated to the library, and it leads him to her, and it's almost like Edward Appleby's ghost is leading him to Miss Cross.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in a way, he's like a suitor for her, but he's also like the son that she never got to have because Edward Appleby died. And then at the same time, you've got Bill Murray's character, whose marriage is failing and who is miserable and has all the hallmarks of sort of almost a madman character. Like, he's like the main guy in John Cheever's story, The Swimmer. He's this suburban kind of post poster guy for Malaise, you know, and he's, you expect him to go jogging and run into Lester Burnham from American Beauty. Like, that's the situation that he's in. And yet, he's a father figure to Max, but Max already has a father. So in a way, he's almost like a big brother, but they're romantic rivals. And it's just, it's very complicated. And you don't know what roles exactly to assign to any of these three. And if you're trying to diagram the relationship between them, they don't fit the usual patterns. But you see that again and again and again. The crew in The Life Aquatic, the family and extended community of friends in The Royal Tenenbaums, the community in Moonrise Kingdom, and on and on. I mean, even the animals in Fantastic Mr. Fox, the forest creatures and the way that they interrelate, they're a family and yet they're not a family. Some of them are related and they seem like they're very close family members, and others don't get along at all. And there are people who are not related who act as if they're part of the same family and have been their entire lives. And, you know, this even extends to the geography of his movies and the way that all geography in Wes Anderson's films is kind of fantastic. Like, it's like he's saying all the labels don't really matter, the boundaries don't matter, the map doesn't matter. You can just make it, you know, make it up, find your way. It's very hopeful.
Right. The fictional East European country were for the Grand Budapest Hotel, this nebulous sort of piece of New England coastal real estate in the Moonrise Kingdom, India in Darjeeling Limited. Yeah.
And he's got the made-up sea creatures in The Life Aquatic that aren't even trying to look real. They're not even trying to look like real sea creatures. Like, that, the entire point of them is that they are obviously stop-motion puppets, like something you would see in, like, a Rankin-Bass puppetoon from the 1960s. That's, like, the whole point. I love that. That was the point where I always liked Wes Anderson, but it was The Life Aquatic's my favorite of his movies, and the animals in The Life Aquatic were a big part of the reason why, because that was the point where I said, this guy's fearless. He's absolutely fearless. Who spends, what was it, $30, $35 million, which is a lot for him, on this nautical adventure, and it's very, very pokey. It's got almost a stoner vibe, and the sea creatures are completely not realistic. How can you not respect that, even if you don't like it?
My guest today is Matt Zoller-Seitz, a TV critic for New York Magazine. He'll be appearing at a Booksmart Tulsa event this Thursday at 6 o'clock at Philbrook Museum, and his most recent book, The Wes Anderson Collection, which looks through most of the... it doesn't include Grand Budapest Hotel, but every film that Wes Anderson did up through Moonrise Kingdom. And what I love about this book is you give us the sense of this auteur vision that Wes Anderson has. You were talking about Mr. Bloom earlier in Rushmore, and you show us the scenes from The Graduate that sort of mirror this Graduate, the idea of, you know, that 60s vibe that's a part of those scenes with Mr. Bloom in Rushmore, or the fascination with Rear Window. And once you see that fascination, I was thinking of even films I hadn't seen in preparation for this, where it's like people are looking through windows, they're looking out of doors, they're looking into doorways. This is sort of a trademark shot for him.
It is, yeah. Voyeurism, like, not just voyeurism, because voyeurism, just the basic act of being a voyeur, is part of movies and always has been, and everybody does it. But the specific way that he envisions it is influenced, you know, more than anything else, by seeing Rear Window at a very early age, having it be one of the first films he'd ever seen that he thought had obviously was the work of a single personality, and the way that it was being voyeuristic, and the way that, you know, you're in the courtyard with Jimmy Stewart, you're looking through windows. His window frame is creating a frame within a frame, and then there are more frames within frames when he's the people he's spying on across the way. And Wes does that in his framing. He's using doors, he's using windows, he's using, you know, all sorts of horizontal and vertical mats, M-A-T-T-E-S, to cut the frame apart. And there's almost like a Mondrian sort of quality to some of the compositions. That's his thing. And the rectilinear, perfectly centered compositions are one of his things. He's got a lot of things.
He does. I think one of the things that I found interesting in the book was you sort of lay out a series of what I guess you might call would be dollhouse shots.
Yes.
Where you're peering into a space, much as like you're looking into a dollhouse, a room into a dollhouse where the action is taking place. And
yes,
this is a technique he uses. I was thinking of Grand Budapest Hotel, the boy that's in the hotel.
Zero. The lobby boy?
Lobby boy, yes.
Yeah.
The lobby
the
boy. Yeah, the lobby boy. Well, who's the
one
narrator
of them anyway.
Yeah, the lobby boy who has this little space, this little room, and you know, there are just tons of these shots of where you're looking into a train compartment. Again, just this dollhouse effect.
Yes, absolutely. That's a very big deal for him. And he, in fact, it was funny. Wes just told me, I asked him about his Frames Within Frames just a couple of days ago, and he told me something about a Grand Budapest Hotel that I didn't realize, which is those train shots. The shots when you're looking out the window of a train and you're seeing the train traveling, like they're slowing down, they're going into a station, and they stop, and you see some soldiers there, and they're perfectly centered in the window. Well, the way he did that shot was he had the camera on a dolly representing the train. It's not an actual train. And then he built this thing in front of the lens to make it look like a train window, and then he had the actors sitting on a platform in front of that. And so it's like a little box. It's like a little dollhouse box containing the actors, and some, you know, technicians are pushing it on a dolly, the grips, and they come to a perfectly centered halt on these soldiers, including, you know, Edward Norton, I guess. And I asked him, I said, you know, you could have just done it with a green screen. You could have saved yourself a lot of trouble. And he said, yeah, but if you do, he said, I thought about that, but if you do it as a green screen, you have to send a camera out on location and film those soldiers anyway, and you have to get on the dolly. And I thought, well, since I'm going to be on a dolly anyway shooting these soldiers, I might as well put, you know, my actors on there and build a little train thing, and that way I don't have to do green screen. I get it all in one shot.
No.
That's how this guy's mind works.
And it sounds like he's really a film guy, not necessarily a digital person, but a film guy.
He is, although he's softened a little bit on that. Like, he's not like Quentin Tarantino. Tarantino recently gave a press conference at Cannes where he was lamenting the death of celluloid and, you know, film as film. Like, when we say a film by so-and-so, we're usually talking about something that was shot on high-definition video. That's kind of the way things are going. And when we say, are you filming, we mean, are you videotaping? Except there's no tape anymore. It's just going straight to a chip or a card. There's all these words that don't refer to anything real anymore. You know, like they're signifiers, but they don't actually mean what they used to mean. And Wes used to seem a little troubled by that, even a few years ago, but I don't get the feeling that he is now. Mm. And his feeling now is he wants to keep shooting on film. Every time he shoots on film, it gets a little bit harder to get the film stocks he wants because they're, you know, they keep eliminating different varieties of film stock because there's not as much demand. It's getting harder to develop. Quality control on the developing of film is a little bit harder than it used to be, and so forth. And ultimately, it's going to be projected digitally. He's already shot a movie digitally. The Fantastic Mr. Fox was shot entirely digitally. So he's comfortable with it. And he said when film goes away, he'll be sad, but he'll keep making movies. They'll just be shot digitally. Mm. And he really doesn't seem like he's just saying that. He really does seem like he's comfortable with it. And I don't think he's going to be giving any press conferences talking about how cinema is dead and has been replaced by television. I don't think he believes that.
My guest today is Matt Zoller Seitz, TV critic for New York Magazine. He is the author of The Wes Anderson Collection, and he'll be appearing here in Tulsa for Booksmart Tulsa, an event this Thursday at 6 o'clock at Philbrook Museum, then a showing of Bottle Rocket following the event at the Circle Cinema. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. A big part of the book are these interviews that you do with Wes Anderson about each film, which are ostensibly about the film, but you go far afield. It's basically just trying to get him to come out on, you know, his views on filmmaking in general about certain things in each particular film. But you mentioned earlier that Wes can be very circumspect, and that becomes that's very apparent from these interviews because you can sort of postulate this long question and he'll go,
Yeah. Well, he doesn't answer questions he doesn't want to answer. And I thought it was important to preserve that because how a person, you know, when a person doesn't answer a question, it tells you something. And the way in which they don't answer the question tells you something. And to me, that's one of the most revealing parts of the entire book is that he's extremely forthcoming about a whole lot of different things. But when you try to dig deep into the themes and the meaning of his films, he just shuts the door and locks it. And that's fine. And, you know, I'm working on a new book right now, a new director book with Oliver Stone that's going to be out next year, and it's going to be a very different book. And one of the reasons it's going to be very different, aside from the fact that Stone and Anderson are about as different as two filmmakers can be, is the fact that Oliver Stone is comfortable talking about the themes and the motifs and the meaning of his movies. Like, he'll tell you what he was trying to do. He'll tell you what he meant. He'll tell you what he thought worked and didn't work. There are other things he's not interested in talking about that Wes is interested in talking about. Wes will talk about the style of a movie, the technique of a movie, the basic actual physical materials of a movie for pages and pages and pages. He loves it. Stone, not so much. One of the things that was most surprising to me about talking to Stone for this new book is he doesn't want to talk about the shots. He doesn't want to talk about the lighting. He doesn't want to talk about the editing so much. He wants to talk about the story, the characters, the themes. Like, in that way, he's almost the reverse or the inverse of Wes.
It seems like Anderson is kind of like an artist in the way of, you know, you look at a picture, what does this mean? What do you think it means?
That's absolutely his position. In fact, you know, I'll tell you a little story here, which is Wes asked me to do a video essay about the Darjeeling Limited, the Blu-ray of the Darjeeling Limited, which came out, I guess, 4 years ago. And I had just begun work on the book. And he said, you know, I said, what do you want me to do? Is there any particular way you want me to approach it? And he said, no, just do the thing that you do, which I like. And I said, okay, fine. So I did a video essay about the Darjeeling Limited. It ran about 9.5, 10 minutes or something. And it was written, it was narrated, I edited it, put it all together, and the notes came back from Wes saying, I like this, but I think it sounds too definitive. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, I am afraid that by including this on the disc, which I am personally signing, like literally signing, like his signature is on the cover, that people will get the impression that this is the official approved interpretation of the Darjeeling Limited. And I don't want them to think that, you know? And I said, well, but it's not. It's clearly not you. It's me. My name is the name on this. So nobody's going to mistake this for the opinion of Wes Anderson. And he said, yeah, but it's on the disc, which I'm supervising, so they might. And is there any way that you can make it a little more clear that this is just Matt's view of the film? And I said, okay, let me think about it. And what I eventually came up with was I asked a producer, Criterion, I said, if I give you a printout of my written narration for this, will you sit across me in a recording studio and interview me about the Darjeeling Limited using this as a crib sheet? And we'll just record the results, and I'll use that as the audio track. And that's what we did. And so if you go back and listen to that video essay, you hear, it sounds like I am just spontaneously coming up with all of this stuff. And I'm trying to remember what I said, essentially, the first time I recorded the narration. But it's halting. It's conversational. There are stops and starts. I kind of meander. I blind alleys all over the place. But it feels like it's just Matt talking. And so I cut the video essay again. I used that as the audio track, showed it to Wes, and he said, this is perfect, and that's what's on the disc. And the reason I tell you all that is that that is his philosophy. Like, what he did with me, like, I'm a critic. I've been doing this for 25 years now. We've known each other for 20 years. He asked me to do the video essay because he wanted my critical take on the film included on the disc, and yet he wanted to make sure there was psychological space for the viewer to have their own opinion and not feel pressured by me or by implication by Wes into thinking a particular thing about the movie. And I respect that. I like that. I think it's really, really nice. Like, it's a nice thing to do.
All right, well, thank you so much. Congratulations on the Wes Anderson collection, and we look forward to your appearance in Tulsa.
I appreciate it.
Film critic Matt Zoller Seitz speaking about his book, The Wes Anderson Collection. Booksmart Tulsa will present its own Wes Anderson experience with the author tomorrow evening from 6 to 8 at Philbrook and a post-event screening of Bottle Rocket at the Circle Cinema at 8:30. Details at booksmarttulsa.com. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.